Welcome to the Trinity's Podcast, where we explore theories about the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Do you love God enough to think about Him?
Episode 61, Dr. Dustin Smith on Pre-existence in Ancient Jewish Thought. Dr. Dustin Smith is an instructor at Atlanta Bible College. He has a PhD in religion from Bethany Divinity School, where his doctoral dissertation, which has now been published, was called Paradoxical Conquering in the Apocalypse of John. He's one of three participants in a forthcoming book called Three Views on Christology. He's published several articles on biblical theology, and he has served on the pastoral staffs of three churches. His blog, called Dustin Martyr, covers mainly New Testament studies. You can find it at dustinmartyr.wordpress.com. Dr. Smith, welcome to the Trinity's Podcast.
Thanks, Dale. Thanks for having me.
In a series of posts on your blog, you've discussed many texts in which ancient and early medieval Jews described various things as existing before the cosmos. Can you give us some examples of statements like this?
Yeah, I think in some of the both Jewish literature that we have within the pages of the scriptures and also outside in the extra-biblical Jewish literature, we have examples of quite a few things, people, concepts, which are spoken of in a way that sounds like it's pre-existence. One in particular comes from a document called Genesis Rabbah, or Bereshit Rabbah, as it's sometimes distinguished. And the quotation goes like this: Six things preceded the creation of the world. Some of them were actually created, while the creation of others was already contemplated. The text goes on and it explains a few of these. It explains the Torah and the throne of glory were created. The creation of the patriarchs was contemplated. The creation of Israel was contemplated. The creation of the temple was contemplated. And the name of Messiah was contemplated. So it's interesting here that things which precede the creation of the world in the mind of this particular Jewish author, he actually divides into two subcategories: those which are actually created, which he lists the Torah and the throne of glory, and those which were just contemplated, as in thought up within God's mind and purposes. And in that list, he places the patriarchs, I assume Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Israel as a nation, and the name of the Messiah was also contemplated. And that passage comes from Genesis Rabbah, chapter 1, verse 4. That's one passage in particular. Further along in Genesis Rabbah, chapter 8, and verse 2, the author says that the architect, moreover, does not build it out of his head, but employs plans and diagrams to know how to arrange the chambers and the wicket doors. Thus, God consulted the Torah and created the world, while Torah declares, in the beginning God created, beginning, referring to Torah, as in the verse, the Lord made me from the beginning of his way. What it actually does there is it identifies Torah with the wisdom from the citation of Proverbs chapter 8 and verse 22. But it explains how this Torah was, in the mind of this particular author, consulted. It talks about an architect who consults things from a plan or a diagram. And it uses this as a way of speaking of things which pre-exist. And again, that passage is Genesis Rabbah, chapter 8, and verse 2. Another interesting example comes from the person of Moses. And in the pseudepigraphal work called The Testament of Moses, chapter 1, verse 14, we could see that the great figure Moses says the following. These words are put into the mouth of Moses. It says, "But God did design and devise me, and he prepared me from the beginning of the world to be mediator of his covenant." I just think it's interesting there that Moses, an extremely prominent person within the hopes and aspirations and history of Judaism, is spoken of in a way that's actually pre-existent. But the pre-existence there is a way which seems that it's prepared. He's someone that is in God's mind and plan, that God has designed and devised him and prepared him from the beginning of the world. But it's not just for a random haphazard purpose. The author has a purpose in mind, it says with a purpose clause, to be mediator of his covenant. And so as we see with Genesis Rabbah, the patriarchs are contemplated from the foundation of the world. And Moses is prepared and devised and designed from the beginning of the world. Genesis Rabbah also spoke of the name of the Messiah from the foundation of the world. We also see in the Targum on Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 7, which says that God will reveal his Messiah whose name is spoken from the beginning. It's interesting that both with this example in Targum Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 7, it's not the Messiah per se, but it's just the name of the Messiah. They're kind of taking one step back. It's the name of the Messiah which was spoken from the beginning. Again, very similar language that we saw in Genesis Rabbah. Another passage we could look at come from the Babylonian Talmud, Nidiim, section 39b, says that seven things were created before the world was made, and they are Torah, repentance, the Garden of Eden, Gehenna, the throne of glory, the house of the sanctuary, and the name of the Messiah. All these things are extremely important within the mindset of Jews and Judaism. Obviously, Torah, repentance, the throne of glory, the house of the sanctuary, and the name of the Messiah. But even locations, the Garden of Eden and Gehenna, were all planned and created before the world was made. Now, obviously, there's no Gehenna up there in heaven at the beginning of creation. These things seem to be describing important persons and places within God's plans and purposes. And they're so important that the Jewish writers are speaking of them as having already been created from the beginning of the world. It sounds very much like pre-existence, but this pre-existence most naturally seems to make best sense as a notional pre-existence.
Dr. Smith, I can imagine someone hearing this for the first time and saying, well, so what? I mean, maybe these are heretical, really off-base Jewish sources. I mean, if somebody goes around saying that Moses existed before creation, I mean, wouldn't that be to make Moses God? Because doesn't only God exist before the creation? And about, you know, the Garden of Eden existing before the world was made, I mean, that's nonsense. The Garden of Eden is part of the world. It can't exist before the world was made. How would you reply to objections like that?
Well, I think you could find a lot of these examples within the pages of scriptures, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. And there's a variety of these which we could use, and it would be nice to have the time to be exhaustive just to make the point. But one in particular comes out of 2 Kings chapter 19 and verse 25, which a very literal translation will say, "Have you not heard?" This is God speaking. "Long ago, I did it. From ancient times, I planned it. Now, I have brought it to pass." And so, God here is speaking, and he's speaking of the plans which he has had from such a long time ago. And these plans are so sure to come to pass that he can actually say, "Long ago, I did it." But in the parallelism, it says, "From ancient times, I planned it." So God's plans, which are so sure to come to pass, because God keeps his promises, and he's a God that can be taken at his word, he can speak of things as having already occurred with the words, "I did it." They've already been planned, and now he's going to bring them to pass.
So one answer to my objector is that these aren't just oddball sources, and they're not just extra-biblical sources or post-Christian Jewish sources, but even the Bible talks about things as pre-existing, such as God's actions in history. I guess in 2 Kings, in that passage, he's talking about something he's doing, punishing a city or something. But what about the point about saying that Moses is God, or that it makes no sense for a portion of the creation to exist before the creation?
That would seem to be quite odd to our ears as modern Western thinkers, because we've been trained to take things very literally. However, we have to take into account when we're reading ancient literature to place them within their context, to allow for various idioms and figures of speech to have their day in court. And if we do find them, then we have to use that as an interpretive grid to read other similar passages, not just to read them, but to correctly interpret them. Because if an ancient author is employing an idiom or figure of speech, and we aren't aware of this, and with our best efforts and ingenuity, we can only come up with a literal reading of things, then we're going to miss the point. I can think of students that come over to America, and they hear someone having trouble speaking and they're coughing, and the American says that they have a frog in their throat. And someone who doesn't understand that idiom, maybe from another culture, tries to interpret that as literally as possible, and they wonder why it's strange that we are eating frogs. And that would be, you know, with their best intentions, they're missing the point because they're not aware of those idioms. So for the purpose of interpreting ancient literature, we need to examine whether those idioms and figures of speech are present, and if so, we need to be responsible historians and interpreters and to take them seriously.
So I can't just jump at the language and say pre-existence means pre-existence, dang it, and don't try to get out of it, because this is a well-known idiom within these languages, right, of describing things as pre-existent but not literally meaning them to pre-exist. What's the point? We could explain the frog in your throat metaphor. You know, it's, we say that because the person's croaking. It kind of sounds like a frog. How can we unpack this talk of the Garden of Eden existing before creation, or Moses existing before creation, or the name of the Messiah? How could we spell that out literally then? What's the point of that language if it's not meant to be literal?
I think when we look at this, we can come to a conclusion that everything and person of value and importance within the mind of Jews who would speculate on such subjects can be spoken of and are spoken of as already existing with God from the beginning. So it's not just pointless things like, you know, a rabbit or a trail or a tree. These are Moses, the patriarchs, the name of the Messiah, the Garden of Eden. These are extremely prominent things. These are things of value. These are things of extreme worth. So it seems like the most prominent things and persons within the mind of Jews who would speculate about such things are spoken of as already existing. But of course, we could actually ask the question, did Moses literally live and breathe up there in heaven prior to the creation of the world? Well, no. Obviously, we know that Moses, according to the biblical narrative, was born. Same thing with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, obviously, things were created. The Garden of Eden was created. Repentance is a concept. I mean, how can a concept pre-exist except for within, I think, the direction that we're going is that they exist precisely as that, as a concept, as a thought, as a plan, and as a purpose. And God has these plans and purposes, and he carries them out in their appropriate time. But it demonstrates that God does have a plan, and he's going to bring it to pass. And these important peoples and persons that function within the history of Israel are so important that he's already had his mind made up of how they're going to be implemented into the narrative of the world's history from the beginning. And that's how these Jewish authors seem to be using such language and imageries.
I hear you saying there's a couple of different points to describing these things as being created before the world was made, or as having always been around. And one of them is that by putting things in the ancient past, it makes them seem important. They are from of old, at least in God's mind. And another point is that they are part of God's eternal plan. God didn't just set off making a world and, I think I'll see what happens. He did have a direction he was going with this. And furthermore, that plan included things like the Torah, Moses and Abraham and the Messiah. And when I think about it as a philosopher who's worked on the philosophy of time, I think that describing future things as present or past is a way of expressing that they are settled, that they're unavoidable. If we talk about something as future, it might actually be settled. I take it that it's settled that Jesus is going to come back in the future. There's no possibility of that not happening. But still, when we talk about the future, we have it in our minds that the thing may or may not happen. At least speaking of things as future kind of reminds us of that. And so if we rather describe it as present or past, then that makes it settled. It's too late for anybody to avoid it or to change it or do anything about it. So do you think that this is part of the point of the biblical authors and the other ancient Jewish authors, that these are unchangeable facts?
You know, I would assume that the Creator God that is revealed in the Scriptures is being described as someone that has plans and purposes. And these things are said to give the readers of these texts hope and assurance and confidence in this God as being one who is faithful. We can see some of the examples that we can continue to multiply deal with these particular things. For example, in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 18, where it says, "On that day, Yahweh made a covenant with Abram, saying, 'To your descendants, I have given this land.'" Well, at this point in the narrative, Abram doesn't even have any descendants, and God says, to your descendants, I've already given this land. Well, obviously that hasn't happened yet in a literal way, but God is speaking of things as they are so sure to come to pass, they can already speak of them as something in the past tense, or in the Hebrew, in a call perfect.
So in describing this as having already happened, God is reassuring Abraham. He's not saying, hey, this is something that might happen, or this is something that I'm currently planning will happen. He's saying, no, this is a done deal, man. It's like I've already done it.
You know, I think I'm very comfortable with that, and I don't want to get into questions of what later Christian theologians talked about regarding predestination and free will, and I'd rather not get into that. I don't think that's how Jews would articulate these things. I think they were more concerned with God being a covenant God, God being a God that is faithful, that has plans and promises, and he's going to carry them out, reassuring God's people that he cares for them, and that he has plans and purposes for them, and especially in times of trouble or in times when Israel's being carried away into captivity or the temple's being destroyed. We have this type of literature out there to reassure the readers and reassure the audience that God is going to enact judgment. He's going to do things. He's going to vindicate the faithful people. And I think it's perhaps best said that the literature is used to reassure those sort of promises.
It strikes me that this type of talk is found in many languages. Even in present-day English, we will describe some future event as present or past as a way of expressing that it is definitely going to happen. There's no possibility of its being averted. For instance, if you admire my hat and I say, oh, you like my hat, it's yours. Now, of course, right now it's not yours, it's still mine. But what I'm saying is you can count on my giving it to you. So I'm describing, instead of saying I'm going to give it to you after the party or whatever, I'm saying you already have it. It's just as sure as if you already have it. Or imagine a coach talking to his football team, and maybe the football team is really great and they're playing the worst team in the league, and the coach says, this game is in the bag. In other words, he's saying that we've already won it. Now, of course, they haven't already won it because they haven't even started to play that game yet, but he's saying that it is going to happen. This victory is something that you can count on just as much as if it had already happened. So even in English, we understand this manner of speaking, of pulling the future back into the present or past as a way to express that it's really settled, that it's something that we can count on.
Absolutely. I like those examples because they bring out the fact that there are idioms that are being employed to demonstrate the certainty of the outcome which is being expressed.
Now, Dr. Smith, you mentioned notional preexistence, and I tend to think about this sort of stuff like a philosopher. Maybe I'm too literal-minded, but the way I think about it, notional preexistence isn't really a kind of existence. It's really just a way of saying that something is being thought about, or maybe that it's being pre-planned, thought about ahead of time. So for instance, maybe I plan to build my dream house someday. Then we say that my dream house exists in my mind or has notional pre-existence. We all understand that way of talking, I think. That's just to say that Dale has plans for his dream house. And so when the house, if I were to build my dream house someday, we don't think that it literally has moved out of my mind onto a piece of property somewhere. Rather, I built it. It comes to exist. It's not just switching from one kind of existence to another, or adding an additional kind of existence to the one it already has, like it has mental existence and now we give it physical existence. No, it's just I bring it into existence, and that's the literal truth, that it doesn't exist until it's built. But then figuratively, we say that it pre-existed in my mind, or that it had notional pre-existence. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, I like that. And I think you bring out a good point that needs to be said, that this word preexistence is actually a very slippery word. I should also point out and admit that preexistence as a word in Greek would be proipārkon, is actually not a word found anywhere in the Bible or in the Greek text. I think you will find it in the second century with Justin Martyr, but you won't find the word proipārkon, to preexist, anywhere in the New Testament. Now, what you do find, though, is more like a foreknowledge, which brings to mind this, what you just spoke about concerning things that are in the plan, things that you have in mind, things that you would like to do, concepts. I can think of the passage in the commissioning of Jeremiah, in Jeremiah chapter 1 and verse 5, where Yahweh says, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, and before you were born, I consecrated you for a specific purpose. I have appointed you as a prophet to the nations." So prior to Jeremiah coming into existence in the womb of his mother, God already knew him. He already knew him in his plan. And before he was born, the parallelism tells us that he was consecrated. He was set apart. And this consecration has nothing to do with being made pure, but it was being designated for God's task that he had for his spokesman, for the prophet. And we can see similar things in the New Testament. You could see in the book of 1 Peter. This is in 1 Peter chapter 1. "To those who reside as aliens scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia, who are chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father." They were chosen according to God's foreknowledge, his proyenosine, his pre-knowledge, his understanding that goes all the way back to the beginning. And I think that if we were to talk about notional pre-existence, I think that's the word that is being used. It's foreknowledge, God knowing things. And when we talk about people knowing things, these are things that are within their mind, their concept, their plans, and their purposes, which seems to also fit the evidence that we witnessed in the extra-biblical Jewish literature.
So this is an important point. I think the language of foreknowledge doesn't imply or even suggest that the thing which is foreknown exists when it's foreknown. My future dream house, if I say someday I'm going to build a house, a big old white house or something, nobody thinks that what I just said implies that the house already exists in some strange way. It's consistent with its only coming into existence at some future time, right? And you make the point, well, it's really foreknowledge language that's prominent in these ancient sources, foreknowledge and pre-planning. But again, pre-planning doesn't presuppose the existence of the thing that's planned at the time when it's planned, right? And I think there's a good reason why they don't use the Greek equivalent of the English word pre-existence, and that's that it's probably a paradoxical expression, right? It's pre-existence is existence before the thing exists. Well, that's one use of the term, as existing in some way before it exists. So it exists and it doesn't exist. Although I think in the case of Jesus, which we'll talk about next week, when people say pre-existence, they just mean his existence before his human life, before he was human. But anyway, I think there's a good reason why that language isn't used. It kind of sounds contradictory, whereas foreknowledge and foreplanning don't.
Right. And I think as we continue to look at the examples where this sort of language is employed, you could look at places in Paul, like in Romans 8, where Paul can say in verse 29, "For those whom he," this is God, "whom he foreknew, he also," my translation says, "predestined," but this is a foreordained, and it has a purpose, "to become conformed to the image of his son, so they might be the firstborn among many brethren." And the passage goes on, "Those whom he predestined, he also called, and those whom he called, he also justified." And here's the kicker, "and those whom he justified, he also glorified." But glorification for Paul means resurrection. But Paul is saying right here that within God's foreknowledge, these things are so sure to come to pass that he can speak of them as having already occurred, despite the fact that Christians have not yet been glorified. The resurrection of the just has not taken place yet. But he could speak of these things as having already come to pass and using languages in the aorist tense, in the past tense. But again, it's God's foreknowledge. We can see similar things in Ephesians chapter 1. Well, let me bring to mind Revelation 13:8, which speaks of a lot of things in particular. It specifically talks at the end about the Lamb who has been slain from the foundation of the world. And if anyone wants to think about that in a strictly literal way, it boggles the mind. How can something have been slain from the foundation of the world? That only makes sense when we put it within God's plans and purposes. We see similar things to where the Lamb was involved, or Jesus was within God's plans and purposes from the beginning. Also in 1 Peter chapter 1:20, we already looked at how the recipients of this letter were within God's foreknowledge. But in that same chapter, in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 20, speaks about Christ, who was foreknown before the foundation of the world. Again, using the verb proyunosko, but the text goes on, but he has appeared in these last times for the sake of you, for the sake of you, the recipients. So Jesus was foreknown from the foundation of the world. Again, this is within God's pre-knowledge, his understanding, his plans, and his concepts, just like we saw in Revelation 13:8, but also just like we saw in the Jewish literature. We saw in Genesis Rabbah, we saw in the Babylonian Talmud, we also saw in Targum Zechariah, where the name of the Messiah was contemplated, it was known by God, it existed with God from the beginning of the world. And so we could see that in that sense, the Messiah was planned from the beginning within the mind of the Jews, which would think and speculate about such things. But in no sense do you get that the Messiah is literally pre-existing, literally existing up there, living and breathing alongside God. But he's in there in God's plans and purposes because he's such a prominent person within the hopes and aspirations and theology of Jews.
Dr. Smith, thanks for talking with us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Next week, we'll again talk with Dr. Dustin Smith, and this time it'll be about the pre-existence of Jesus in the Gospel according to John.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you online at trinities.org. Till next time, don't forget to love God with all your mind.